Some of the original 13 colonies made it clear they would not join the fledgling United States unless there was a mechanism put into place to make sure they weren't run over by the big states. Unless there was a mechanism put into place to protect them from the populace and the population centers of the big states, they would not get involved with the formation of the United States. So, our founding fathers devised an ingenious plan to make sure that states were represented fairly. You basically had 50, at that time 13, but now you have 50 separate elections. And the popular winner in each one of those elections is then put into a bigger pool. That's called the Electoral College. And it defends states like, oh, the Dakotas or Montana or Missouri from getting run over by Illinois and New York and Florida and, of course, California. And there was a time when the Democrats believed in defending the Electoral College. Now, of course, they want to get rid of it or do an end run by way of the national popular vote, which I believe is in direct violation of the Constitution. Maybe my next guest can sort it out for us. So, John York, policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. John, welcome to the program.
Great to be on.
Good to have you here. So one of those folks that used to defend the Electoral College before Democrats decided they had to change the rules to win presidential elections was Joe Biden himself. Do tell.
So Joe Biden, and in the past when – sorry, my phone's a little staticky here.
You're good.
Am I getting a little feedback? Okay. Back in when Democrats had a clear advantage in the Electoral College – they supported it. Now they've lost two of the last five Electoral College counts, even despite winning the national popular vote. So as you might predict, Democrats have changed their tune a little bit since the era when Joe Biden came out in support of the Electoral College.
So let me ask you something, because in that regard, you've got this national popular vote compact that's making its way around the country, right? So when when I go to my handy dandy pocket constitution, which I do oftentimes because it puts me at an advantage because I don't think Democrats spend much time reading it. And I go to Article 1, Section 9, and I go all the way to the end of that, Article 1, Section 9, and it reads as follows. And I want you to help me with this, John, to see if I'm understanding this. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, enter into any agreement or compact with another state. Am I missing something?
No, that seems pretty black and white to me. I don't know how it strikes you, but the interstate or the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact seems to be on its face an interstate compact. And as such, it can't go forward without congressional approval. Even though 16 states and now D.C. have signed on, and basically what the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is an agreement between the co-signatories that they're going to cast their Electoral College votes not for the winner of their state, but for the winner of the national popular vote. No matter how many states sign on to that, it's still going to take congressional approval under the Constitution, and you identified the relevant passage in Article 1 right there.
I would believe, but I've had both liberals and conservatives right here on this program tell me that I'm wrong, that has to do with, you know, military action and so forth. It doesn't say that. It doesn't read that way. It's black and white letter law in the Constitution. Because
that's right.
Here's the other scenario I'd lay out for you. Let's say, for example, in Michigan where I live, Donald Trump won in 2016, much to the shock and surprise of the Democrats, but he did. And let's say this was in place, and let's say Michigan had entered this compact, and I had voted for Donald Trump, who under the Electoral College would have gotten the votes of Michigan. Yet I would be disenfranchised as a voter if my vote was basically overturned. My vote was therefore ignored and just put into the popular vote. Would I not have standing then to sue another state or to sue my state for saying, listen, you have disenfranchised me as a voter? This whole nonsense that every vote counts. Well, it wouldn't for me if I was a Trump voter in Michigan in 2016 and that was overturned and handed to Hillary Clinton. I mean,
I think that's exactly how a court challenge would arise. And it would have to happen once the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact had sufficient states to turn an election. They're short now, thank goodness. They have 196 Electoral College votes between them. They need, of course, 270.
Right.
Oregon's governor signed on yesterday. Maine looks like it might sign on. So they're getting closer and closer. But until they have a sufficient number of electoral college votes to turn an election, you wouldn't quite have standing. But once they did, you're exactly right. I think individuals would have standing, and they would bring a suit. And I think, absent congressional action, the letter of the Constitution is quite clear on this.
Yeah, and then of course, there's this portion of the mathematics of it all, which I like. But without California, for example, Hillary Clinton would not have won the popular vote in 2016. The popular vote margin in California was about 3.5 million for Hillary, because almost 62% of the voters voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016 in that state. And the overall margin of victory, if you want to call it that, was 2.5 million nationally. So absent California, Donald Trump did win the popular vote in every other state overall. And so unless you want to surrender your right to choose the chief executive to one state, which is what you would effectively be doing, why would you even want to discuss that, I guess?
It seems like a crazy thing. When you look at states like Maine, especially, a very small state, Vermont, which is signed on, it's very difficult to know what these states are thinking. In the lead-in, you said it exactly right. The founders understood that larger states should have a bigger role to play in choosing the head of state, but small states shouldn't be ignored. And the fact that every state is guaranteed at least 3 electors, no matter its size, and some states do have only that number, North Dakota, South Dakota,
sure,
et cetera, ensures that they're not completely absent from the process. Also, the fact that candidates are never going to go through every county in the country. Democrats often say this, well, every vote will count.
But they
not
don't.
Not really. Presidents will be incentivized to go to, just as you said, the population
center. Exactly right.
California, New York, Chicago.
And one other thing that I think is really important here, that I believe is a related conversation right now. We only have about a minute left here. York from Heritage Foundation will be. But that is the counting of illegal aliens in the census in California. Mm-hmm. Because if you have 3.5 million or 4 million illegal aliens, which I think is being conservative in California, that gives you 5 members of Congress you're not entitled to. That gives you more power in the Electoral College. It gives you more power in national politics that you should not have because you have people living there illegally. So you're ignoring federal law and then getting more federal power. And that is a problem. I'll give you the last word.
Hugely important. And if we got away from the Electoral College, the problem of illegal aliens voting would be even greater, because right now illegal aliens are clustered in states that are going Democrat anyway. But if they were counted one for one, they could swing the national popular vote in its entirety rather than swing one or two states.
That's right. And I also believe, you know, if those coming across the southern border were Republican voters, that border would have been closed years ago. At any rate, John, I greatly appreciate you being here. You know that's true. We can have a little fun.
Absolutely.
With it.
Look at how they treated Cuban immigrants.
Exactly. What are you doing here? Go home. Yeah, exactly. John York, thank you so much.
Thanks.
John York from the Heritage Foundation. If you can't win fairly, damn it, we'll change the rule. It's the Steve Gruber Show. We'll be right back.
When I was little, I didn't talk for a long time. I liked things to always be the same. Anything new or different would scare and upset me. I was very sensitive to lights and sounds. It was almost like I had bigger eyes and ears than everyone else. So I built secret hiding places where nothing could get in. I didn't like looking people in the eye. It made me feel uncomfortable. I'd throw big tantrums over little things, like when my socks didn't match. Sometimes I'd do the same things over and over, until one day I found out I had autism. My family got me help. Slowly, I learned how to live with it better.
You can see signs of autism in children as young as 18 months. Early intervention can make a lifetime of difference. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
You're not wired to have a response to this sound. You're neutral to it. You hear it every time you finish a meal and never feel anything. But if we were able to associate this sound with a new stimulus, save the food, we've achieved pulling a natural response from you. Save the food. Why are we doing this, you may ask? Save the food. because this ad is trying to change your after-meal behaviour through brainwashing. Because food waste costs the average family $1,500 a year. Save the food! Cha-ching! And $1,500 extra is like getting a pay raise. Save the food! Cha-ching!
You're promoted!
Which could pay for your child's braces. Save the food! Cha-ching!
You're promoted!
Check out my braces!
So, when you hear this sound, rethink your behaviour. Cook it, store it, share it. Just don't waste it. For tips and recipes, visit savethefood.com. Brought to you by NRDC and the Ad Council.